bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad you can join us. Florida is at it again. The sun is setting on the racist diversity programs that became all the rage after the death of George Floyd, thanks to action on the part of Floridians. Also, a jailbreak of thousands of criminals is wreaking havoc in the already unstable nation of Haiti. And European Union countries who fell in line with vax passports are experiencing excess death rates. But one member country told the EU to pound sand, and it's not. We'll be discussing those stories soon. But first, Joe Biden's Attorney General, Merrick Garland, recently told a black church in Selma, Alabama, that the Department of Justice is fighting to force states to adopt mail-in voting and ballot drop boxes for the 2024 election, as well as to end voter ID laws. Garland told the Tabernacle Baptist Church that the Department of Justice is fighting attempted safeguards by certain states with legislatures working to secure their elections. Now, just before the 2020 election, multiple states began exploiting the fabricated COVID freakout to unconstitutionally implement election policies that made it easier to cheat. Among the most blatant were the massive push for mail-in ballots and ballot drop boxes, none of which were implemented through proper legislative processes. As a result, the senile suspected criminal now occupying the White House managed to garner an astounding 81 million votes, all while campaigning from his basement. Now, this is quite the feat, and those of us whose brains haven't been turned to mush by the constant drip of propaganda can't help but suspect that all those videos of people stuffing ballot boxes in the middle of the night might have had something to do with that. The New American attended CPAC recently, and one of the people we spoke to was Hogan Gidley, who is America First Policy Institute's vice chair of the Center for Election Integrity. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko asked him where we stand today on election integrity. Gidley began by saying that we're in better shape than we were in 2020. And here he is discussing an example of that with Arizona.
Well, Arizona is a great example. There was a bill that we kind of helped put forward with some groups there on the ground that had signature verification stuff and voter identification stuff in there. And Katie Hobbs, the governor, vetoed it a year ago. Well, just recently, a bill came before the legislature that Katie Hobbs had to sign that, in essence, put some dates and timelines on when they could actually hold an election. And she had to sign it, because if she didn't, they couldn't have an election this year. There were some benchmarking dates they had to do, and she had to sign the bill quickly. So Republicans smartly added back in those signature verification requirements and voter ID requirements. So she had to sign a bill. She didn't want to. And now they're being sued. We're being sued. Everyone's being sued. Because for whatever reason, it's always interesting to me to see that Democrats don't want drop boxes monitored for some reason. It's always interesting to me to see Democrats say, you don't need voter ID to vote. It's just kind of weird as to why they would be so concerned about people actually monitoring, you know, the election process and how these accountability measures and transparency measures are being put in place. And they don't like that for some reason. And I think I know why.
Joining me to discuss today's stories is executive senior editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve Bonta.
Hello.
So as far as I'm concerned, we haven't made a whole lot or the necessary process to completely secure the elections. I think the Trump campaign probably knows this because one of its mantras is too big to rig. So they're anticipating cheating and whatnot. But I find it interesting. Well, I don't know if interesting, not surprising or interesting, I suppose. But this is what Democrats do, is I think they exploit the fears and the suspicions of certain groups, and then they lie to them. And this isn't just about black people or Hispanics. They do this with poor whites as well. And they lie to them. It's like there is no drawback. There is no disadvantage to having secure elections, but they go into and they lie to these people and they try to weaponize them against what would benefit everyone else.
Right. I mean, one of the things that of course is frustrating, and the motive behind what Merrick Garland is trying to do with the Department of Justice, which is to effect to safeguard existing election policies like drop boxes through the executive branch, okay, is that it's a direct contravention of Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution, which contains the so-called Election Clause, which is an interesting piece of, I would say, sort of compromise, but a balance. It ascribes, on the one hand, assigns the primary authority over determining the manner and place of elections and obviously qualifications for vote and all this sort of thing
to
the states, the state legislature. No, the state legislature. But it also says, but Congress can pass laws. You know, it gives Congress a role also, you know, and Congress has used that, for example, to ensure that there's one election day and not a bazillion different election days all across the country and things like this. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily outside of the purview of Congress to pass laws, you know, regulating the elections and on occasion superseding whatever states have to say about it. But that said, you know, it's very latitudinarian. There is, for example, some states allow convicted felons to vote and others don't. So you know, electoral laws at the state level are not necessarily uniform, okay? But what it doesn't say is that the executive branch can make these determinations. And of course, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch. It has to be done by an act of Congress. Obviously, that's not going to happen with the Republicans in control of the House of Representatives. They can't pass some sort of bill that would permanently guarantee the right to vote in absentia or to use drop boxes or whatever other fictive rights they choose to conjure up out of thin air. They can't do that right now because they don't have the numbers in the House, much as they'd like to. So they're trying to do it by executive fiat, in effect.
Well, what do they have to gain? Because Alabama is not in play in 2024, no matter the cheating or whatnot, Alabama's not in play. So this seems kind of odd, doesn't it? Like Merrick Garland's over there. And obviously this is some sort of power play for the Biden administration, but it doesn't make sense on my end. Would it make sense on your end?
Well, he's messaging to blacks in this case, in states not called Alabama, where...
Mm-hmm. And this is Selma, remember.
I mean, Pennsylvania is a good example of this. Mm-hmm. All of the shenanigans that managed to wrest Pennsylvania away from Trump, despite the fact that he was leading by 800,000 votes.
Right.
Okay.
Until the lights went out.
When they shut down the polls inexplicably, mm-hmm. and all those new votes came out of the Philadelphia area.
Yes.
Many of which were largely black neighborhoods and so forth. That's what's going on. It's a bit of dog whistling.
Yeah. And you know, this idea, and I think we've discussed this before, but I can't help but mention it again. This idea that voter IDs, that anything that requires a little bit more work to secure the elections is disenfranchisement, is just an insult to the people that they're speaking this to, because they're saying, well, you know, you may be capable of having a voter ID or the necessary requirement to get your food stamps or whatever, but you're certainly not capable of doing any of that if it comes to, you know, when it comes to making one of the most responsible decisions as a citizen. I don't understand how they don't see that. It's like, why are they so dumb or ignorant or incapable of getting a voter ID when everyone else is? How do they not see that?
Well, you know, again, it goes back to this grievously mistaken idea that we're a pure democracy. And in a democracy, the right to vote is kind of the paramount franchise, okay? But unfortunately for these people, we're not, or at least we were not originally intended to be a democracy. Mm-hmm. This is the reason that under the original Constitution, okay, not only were the requirements for voting widely divergent from state to state, but, you know, and included a racial component. You know, you couldn't vote if you weren't a white male who owned property in many states and this kind of thing, which probably would not be obviously desirable today, wouldn't be, I mean, we've moved beyond that.
Yes.
But it shouldn't serve to obscure totally the original idea that voting in a republic as an act of citizenry should not just be something that you get by virtue of drawing breath and having a pulse.
Right.
And maybe reaching a certain age. It's something that, you know, any more than you just get, have the automatic right to serve in the military by virtue of, I mean, you have to qualify.
Right.
For it. And this was the original idea, was that a citizen who is, you know, fully empowered, who's able to exercise the voting franchise, is someone who's basically worthy of it. And this has been the notion in all other republics in history. But now we have this idea that there should be universal suffrage once you attain the age of 18, this rather arbitrary, mystical age that's been selected. And frankly, you know, most 18-year-olds aren't responsible or well enough informed to be trusted with something like the vote, in my opinion. And I'm sure that would have been the opinion of the founding fathers. So, you know, we've drifted very, very far from our original moorings, mm-hmm. as far as the voting is concerned.
And this is obviously also a response to all the backlash and the attempts at securing. They're not going to stand for it. Thanks, Steve. Next up, Florida universities are beginning to go after racist DEI programs.
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. Picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, the New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25.
The New American has just released our latest bookazine, a collection of articles on self-reliance. It's called Self-Reliance, Foundation of Freedom. Without individual responsibility and without the ability to take care of ourselves without government help, we cannot be free. In this polished collector's edition, we have articles on a number of important topics, including the self-sufficiency of the founders, preparing for a worst-case scenario, firearm self-reliance, building a wood shack, and the importance of community, among many other topics. Now, the authors of the articles are experts in their fields. We encourage you to get a copy. You can order your copy at thenewamerican.com/shop, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783. However you do it, make sure you get your copy of Self-Reliance, the Foundation of Freedom. The University of Florida is saying goodbye to DEI. It's chucking its racist diversity, equity, and inclusion program. This is in response to a bill enacted in the state last May that blocks public colleges from using federal or state funds for these types of programs. 13 UF staff jobs are on the chopping block, as are 15 administrative appointments of faculty members to the diversity office. According to a university memo released last Friday, the annual $5 million previously allocated to DEI expenses will now be funneled into faculty recruitment. Why do they need $5 million every year for a DEI office manned by 13 employees? Well, here are a few ways they were wasting that pile of cash. Last April's City Journal ran an expose by Manhattan Institute senior fellow Christopher Rufo that described how left-wing bureaucrats have embedded identitarian radicalism into virtually every department on campus. Rufo got a hold of publicly available documents from UF that exposed the school's DEI agenda, including its racial and political preferences in faculty hiring, its 12-step program for white employees called Racist Anonymous, and its racially segregated scholarship programs that violate federal civil rights law. Rufo explained that the changes came quite suddenly, following the death of George Floyd in May of 2020. Within 2 months, Chief Diversity Officer Antonio Farias had organized anti-racism measures, and these included mandatory diversity training for all students, faculty, and staff. They also included an entire academic year focused on the Black experience, racism, and inequity, a presidential task force to explore the university's racist past, and recommendations for renaming buildings, removing monuments, and banning historic racist imagery, among other radical programs. In years since, Rufo says the movement has exploded to the point that DEI is not a series of standalone programs, but an ideology that has been embedded in virtually every department on campus. In other words, even though the University of Florida's DEI department is dismantled, that doesn't necessarily mean that Florida is where DEI goes to die, as Governor Ron DeSantis bragged last week. In fact, Florida State University also suffers from a DEI bureaucracy, which Rufo says divides Americans along a matrix of oppression, castigates Christians for their Christian privilege, and offers a racially segregated scholarship that deliberately bars white students from applying. However, as an interesting side note, neither the University of Florida nor Florida State University seem to mind that their football teams are all male and predominantly Black. Other schools in the state that have to cut their DEI programs are New College, which is the Honors College of Florida, Florida International University, and the University of North Florida. All right, Steve. So I fear that this little era here will go down in American history as the stupidest era.
Well, I don't know. It'd have some stiff competition, I suspect. But, you know, I mean, if you... When I went to college and back in the 80s, the administration consisted primarily of, you know, the university president and his staff, the provost and his staff, department chairs and their staff, and, mm-hmm. you know, each college had a head. And that was about it. And you didn't have all of these additional, all this additional intermediary bureaucracy primarily consecrated to the cause of enforcing what used to be called political correctness, and now it has, you know, wokeism, DEI, all these other terms, more or less fungible. What they are is attempts to enforce whatever the, you know, the current left-wing orthodoxy happens to be with regard to gender, with regard to race, all the rest of this.
Yes. Okay, and it's all insane today.
Sure, and so, what another thing, not unconnected, that has happened in the almost 40 years since I was an undergraduate, is that they've created out of whole cloth these sprawling new bureaucracies that have nothing to do with either, you mean, the two traditional things, education and athletics, you know, the two things that the big universities, you know, usually spend money on, but rather to enforcing all this stuff, dealing with all this stuff. And they hire people that they pay absolutely obscene amounts of money.
Yeah.
And so the result has been that resources have been drained away, not so much from the athletic side of things, but certainly from the educational side of things, such that the vast majority of college courses, particularly for undergraduates, are no longer taught by tenured professors, as used to be the case, but by people who are, basically are working year to year, many of them not even full time. Yeah. They're being paid practically nothing. And if you look, I used to follow, you know, the academic jobs market quite much, and it was just amazing how there are no really good jobs in academia anymore. They expect all of these people to go.
You mean they're not well paid? The jobs don't pay.
Oh,
well?
It's incredible. I mean, they advertise for a part-time position that might pay, you know, you teach two courses in a semester and get paid, you know, $1,500 per course, and they advertise worldwide for a position like that, and they expect a person to have a PhD and all the rest of this, you know, to
wow,
to,
seriously,
yeah. So academia is just this isn't the entire cause for what's going on, but a large part of it is that universities have decided they're going to allocate a lot of their scarce resources to paying these useless bureaucrats, after layer of bureaucracy, and these people that head these DEI type departments are commanding large six figure salaries.
They have a $5 million annual
budget.
No,
that's an enormous amount of money. And then correspondingly,
for 13 people.
Well, and also tuition rates have gone through the roof in that same time. In actual adjusted for inflation terms, students today are paying many times what I paid and certainly my parents paid back in the 80s and the 60s, you know, just to pay for college tuition. It is grown all out of relation to inflation. Most higher college, you know, education is a terrible investment today.
Yeah.
Which is why more and more people are moving away from it, getting, you know, online degrees and perhaps not going to college at all, because that it's being destroyed. And a large part of it is this insanity.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you pay that, you know, to send your kid to the University of Wisconsin or Penn State or whatever, and you're paying, you know, $20,000, $30,000 a year in just in tuition to send your kid to a taxpayer-funded university.
Yeah.
Okay. A large part of that is going to support this sort of nonsense.
Well,
on financial terms, leaving aside the corrosive social effects, the financial effect is just terrible. It's a large part of the reason that young people are drowning in college debt.
Yes, but is enrollment going down? Because if that's the case, maybe it's not such a bad thing considering the state of universities that
it seems to be declining in many of the traditional paradigm, you know, where you go to school for 4 years, you live at a bricks and mortar dormitory, and all that sort of thing. People are saying, "Heck with this!
Yeah,
I'll go to a trade school, or I'll get an online degree from DeVry or something like that." University of
Phoenix.
Southern New Hampshire and Phoenix and all these that offer, you know, very creditable online degrees at a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. And they're all credentialed.
Right.
And they can all lead to a good job or to a graduate program. But you're not going to go, you're not going to be in hock $100,000
yeah.
as a result.
And so, those programs are less likely to have this DEI nonsense, at least.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They have very little of it.
Well, it sounds great to me. I mean, this and, you know.
There'll always be a market for education, but it has to be real education. What is going on now is not education, but indoctrination, and perhaps at best, re-education.
Mm-hmm. And, re-education,
and
activism.
And all for a very, very high price tag.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, this doesn't sound all bad. And Rufo has, you know, I've seen interviews with him where he talks about there is this resurgence of classical education, and he's part of that. So it's good to see all that. All right, folks, after this, we're going to talk about what in the world is happening in Haiti.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you, for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
For more news and in-depth analysis from the New American Magazine, the kind that you will not get anywhere else, make sure you have a subscription to our twice monthly print edition of the magazine. No other magazine has been as accurate and for as long about where policy and culture were heading than the New American. You can subscribe online at thenewamerican.com. Just hit the magazine tab on top and then on the drop down, hit the subscribe button. Or if you prefer, you can call for a subscription. Call 1-800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. That's 800-727-8783. Chaos has descended on the Caribbean country of Haiti after well-organized gang militias attacked two large prisons 2 days ago and liberated more than 4,000 prisoners. The freed gang members unleashed an ongoing wave of violence in Port-au-Prince that seems to be evolving into an attempt to overthrow the government. According to the latest reports, the gangs have attacked Haiti's international airport, resulting in the cancellation of all flights in and out of the country. It's not yet clear whether the airport is under gang control. This episode is the latest sad chapter in the second oldest republic in the New World, which in recent years has been ravaged by dictatorships, war, crime, and one of the deadliest earthquakes in recorded history. Haiti is a major source of the ongoing wave of illegal immigrants entering the U.S. from Mexico, and this latest tragedy will probably drive more desperate Haitians to flee the country. Here's some footage from what's going on in Haiti. All right, Steve, so I thought about it. If the criminals take over the government, I think the only difference between their rulers and ours will be that their people will know their rulers are criminals.
Well, yeah, and with very few exceptions, they always have been. I mean, Haiti is the very embodiment of a failed state, and it's been a failed state for the entirety of its more than 200 years of history as an independent country. It is a country that just can't seem to catch a break. So even when they're trying to get things together, they have an earthquake. They don't really have a president right now, or a functioning government.
Who's in charge of
that? Their last president was assassinated a couple of years ago in his home.
Wow.
And by armed marauders, and they just haven't been able to put together a government since then. But I mean, Haiti has an interesting history. It is the only country in world history to have gained independence as a result of a slave uprising. Okay, it was the second independent republic in the Western Hemisphere. The United States, of course, being the first. And, you know, so it achieved some admirable things. Unfortunately, Haiti was birthed not at the time of the American Revolution, but in the context of the French Revolution.
Right, that makes
sense. You know, Toussaint Louverture, the guy who led the Haitian revolt, was actually, had been served as a general in revolutionary France. He and his comrades returned to Haiti, led a slave revolt against the French authorities. But it was based on French revolutionary principles, which is why the national motto of Haiti to this day is Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, which is the motto also of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, fraternity. Okay, mm-hmm. So it should not come as a surprise that Haiti ended up in that. And the moment they got independence, the first thing they did was they went and massacred all of the foreigners except for some Germans and a few Poles who were there, helped them. So they committed genocide on their own account.
Right, just against, like the French.
Yeah, well, against, you know, they like massacred 20,000 French people living in Haiti. They killed them, a large number of them. And so their relationship with the United States and the rest of the world was strained. Vexed. President Adams was a strong supporter. He was very anti-slavery, so he was sympathetic. But he was bookended by two presidents, Washington and Jefferson, who were not as sympathetic, who were concerned. Of course, the Southern states were concerned about a slave rebellion on American soil, being inspired by what was happening in Haiti. So the result was we didn't even recognize Haiti until, I think, 1862 or something like that.
Well, let's.
Not only that, they were forced deep into debt by the French. The French attempted to reconquer them in the 1820s, and the Haitians basically said, "Well, here's the deal. How about if we pay you lots of money not to reinvade us?" And so the French imposed crippling debts on them that they didn't pay off until the 20th century. And if that weren't bad enough, we invaded them in 1915.
Yeah.
Because we were worried that the Germans who were still living in Haiti might become a problem, because the Wilson administration was already considered Germany our enemy, even though we weren't in World War I at that time. So we invaded and occupied Haiti for the better part of 20 years. In that time, we imposed a new constitution on them, written by none other than FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So you can imagine what kind of constitution that was.
Wow.
Okay, so this country can't catch a break.
Well, and then there's this voodoo tradition, and I can't imagine that's a good thing for happening in that country, right?
Well, I mean, originally the voodoo secret societies of Haiti were a vehicle for the revolutionaries. And so it's always enjoyed this status.
Yeah. I think that's telling
within Haiti. Yeah,
about the state of the
country. But it's just
I guess the
overall point is that we have a hard enough time keeping it together here, as current events are bearing out, and we had a really good start with a very sound constitution. It had a few issues that needed to be ironed out, to be sure. But you know, we've had a massive civil war in our history and various periods of instability, of which the current one is certainly one of the most remarkable. And who knows how that's going to end up? But imagine if we had not had a constitutional convention, founders remotely like the founding fathers, but instead people who were coming right out of that French revolutionary tradition. And then in addition, the population are people who, you know, were all slaves, which means that they were all denied the benefits of education and all this sort of thing. There were some exceptions, the Maroons and so forth in Haiti, but it was just a very, very difficult task that they set for themselves. And so aside from the undoubtedly heroic event of emancipating themselves from French
domination.
That's
as far as the goal went, huh?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and after that, they set up a republic, and then there was a rival who set up what he called the Empire of Haiti, and so for a while it was split into two, and then they tried to conquer what's now the Dominican Republic, and that led to another war. It was just but there was no clarity as to what they wanted to accomplish, other than they knew they didn't want to be slaves anymore.
Yeah, and there was no unity or a common agenda.
So it's very sad. And this latest uprising is par for the course, really. And there is a real possibility that these armed gangs could manage to take over the country. It's certainly been done in other places like Somalia and Africa.
Yeah, and given this country's history, it sounds like that's likely to happen. I mean,
the first genuinely elected, you know, democratically elected president that they had was a guy named Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was a certifiable radical left-wing moonbat from the early 1990s. He was a real weirdo and a creep. Back in the day, we had a lot to say about him in the New American.
Wait, tell me more about him. What made him a creep?
He was a liberation theology priest, or at least affected to be so, but he was very, very much, you know, like to foment violent revolutions, spoke approvingly of the practice of necklacing, which means killing a person by imprisoning them inside burning tires and stuff like this. So he was, and he was eventually ousted by a coup, a guy named Raul Cedras back in the 90s. And then we went and invaded Haiti under President Clinton to oust Cedras and to reinstate Aristide, because he was, at least by the American left wing, he was viewed as their man. But he eventually got so extreme and ridiculous that he was deposed by another coup in 2004. And this time we thought, okay, you know what? We're just not going to bother.
Why bother with it? I mean, me and you, we were watching video yesterday and different videos and you know, it's showing the chaos. But meanwhile, there's people who are just going about driving through, doing their entire life, their regular life, which leads me to believe that it's like, this is so normal for some of these people that when these things happen, they're just going to kind of move on by and try to not be affected by it. Well, that's the kind of place it is.
History shows, if it shows nothing at all, it shows that people are capable of tremendous resilience and adaptability. So that people, you know, in certain times in our history, parts of the Dark Ages, the long collapse of the Roman Empire, the period of the Mongol expansion, and many other incredibly tragic periods in history, not to mention the two world wars of the last century and, you know, the tragedy that was Soviet and Chinese communism, ongoing, by the way, people adapt.
Yeah. After this, a Romanian parliament member explains to Senator Ron Johnson the secret to telling the EU to go pound sand.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped from my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
On February 26th, a collection of modern-day rebels, comprising doctors, scientists, psychologists, journalists, propaganda experts, and politicians, converged in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C., to discuss the lies and skullduggery that have been pushed on the world behind the facade of public health. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson led a four-hour roundtable discussion entitled, What Are They Hiding? A large portion of the hearing focused on COVID-19 vaccines, or more accurately, gene therapy injections. In the hearing, experts testified to the huge spike in excess deaths that were seen as a result of the injection. But there was one nation that was the exception, at least one nation. One of the panel guests was Romanian Parliament member Dr. Sorin Munkanciu. Dr. Sorin Munkanciu said Romania refused to implement the vax passport mandates after learning that the push was political and not evidence-based. He also said that as a result, the Romanian vax rate was less than half of other European countries, but more importantly, that Romania had a negative excess mortality rate, whereas the other European Union countries had a positive one. Senator Johnson then asked Munkanciu, what made Romania so special as to resist the EU? Here is his answer.
How would you explain Romania's ability to resist versus the rest of Europe and the United States? I mean, is it cultural? Was it just your ability to convince people or what?
Hesitancy was something that they tried as much as they could to counter. But in Romania, the problem they face is that we are 40 years after a communist dictatorship, 34 years after a communist dictatorship, and it's in our gene, it's in our to distrust the government, because we knew every time a communist government is saying anything or is directing anything, we knew that's a lie, that's something that we should not trust, we should not follow. When the European Union started behaving like the USSR with those commissars coming to us, and Mr. Barnier came to Romania, this gentleman was the commissar for internal affairs of the European Union, and pushed the Romanian parliament to vote the green certificate at the workplace, I definitely opposed that. And I knew they have no scientific base for that. And I asked him in the Romanian parliament, if you ask us to vaccinate people from 18 to 65, you better have a scientific proof that that will, it's what we are looking for. We are to have a proof, a scientific proof to justify that. And he said, no, it should be a political, you belong to European Union, you should follow the directive. Well, guess what? We did not.
All right, Steve. So this is the things that the John Birch Society, the New American has been warning about. This is what it's like. These international organizations, they come in and they try to muscle in its members. There is a prime example. Now, Romania was an exception, whereas the others, they were not. And this is a prime example of what happens when we have these international organizations and the harm that they can cause. Good, bravo, Romani, you know, because they were seem to be some of the only ones, or I'm sure they may not be the only ones, but good for them. And this is a lesson for us too. And Ron Johnson said after that, he later said, you know, Americans have something to learn, and that being that we need to be a little more suspicious of the government.
I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, again, I remember that heady time when all those Eastern European countries were rising up. Romania was the only one that paid the ultimate price for its freedom, as you know. I mean, all of those other revolutions that occurred in the fall of 1989 were bloodless. Romania's was not. Mm-hmm. They paid a pretty severe price. I mean, it didn't last very long, but there was still several days of carnage, particularly in Bucharest and the other large cities.
Timișoara too, yeah.
Sure. I mean, even after the dictator Ceausescu and his wife were executed, all of his supporters, you know, the Securitate, his minions, mm-hmm. Kept up the fight. So I can't help but think that left an impression that was perhaps maybe not as vivid with the likes of, you know, Czechia and the Slovakia, whatever they call them now, Poland, the other countries, that even East Germany, you know, that had basically to do a little more than turn out in the streets en masse, and voila, down came the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And the government's collapse. Romania didn't go quietly into that good night, the Romanian communists. So
no.
Yeah.
So well, you know what? What's interesting, though, is because in the West, and especially France, I remember France had a lot of headlines about, because they were really heavy on these passports. Mm. And in the West, we've always had access here in the West to information, to videos. I mean, we could see what the tyrants did. We see the footage. We can read what they said. And so if you were truly interested in knowing the parallels between between tyrants and what the EU and the WHO and the UN was trying to push, and even the US government, then you could definitely see a relation there. But we didn't see that. There wasn't as much pushback as there was. And that's really concerning.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if you aspire to strengthen the state to the point of being, you know, to set up a tyranny or something, if that's your ambition, okay, you need a pretext. Now, traditionally, people are chary of war. We all kind of know that war is the health of the state and all that stuff, and the times of war are a prime opportunity to create a Department of Homeland Security or to pass a Patriot Act or other measures to restrict people's freedom. And we're I think, comparatively vigilant about that. The thing is, these pandemics are much less frequent events, but history shows that a really severe pandemic, and I don't consider COVID to be really severe. A lot of it was amplified by the media. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Black Death was the most transformative world event in the last 2,000 years, probably. Mm-hmm. Far exceeded, you know, the Mongol depredations, the collapse of the Roman Empire, it completely transformed. It destroyed the entire medieval feudal society, for one thing, and created the conditions for the Renaissance and all the rest that followed. I mean, it really was the great inflection point. But lost in the grandeur of that history are the details of the terrible things that people did to each other at the local level. You know, if you've read Edgar Allan Poe's famous story, The Mask of the Red Death, which is about a fictitious pandemic. It talks about all the elites walling themselves inside capitals and leaving the people outside to die and all this kind of thing. The Prince of Naples literally nailed people, welded people inside their homes to die when the Black Death hit Italy. Mm. And it's hard to understand. So now, obviously, COVID wasn't a patch on that, or even on the Spanish flu pandemic. I think the Spanish flu pandemic would have had more effect had it not occurred kind of in the larger context of World War I. Mm. It was really of a piece with all these other transformative events. So whereas COVID crops up and there is no world war, the war at that time, the world was relatively peaceful. At peace in a state of stasis. It obviously isn't now.
Yes.
But then it was. And so it became this really convenient pretext, frankly, few pandemics before or since have done. Mm-hmm. But others, you know, the Great Plague of Justinian, the Great Plague of Athens during the time of Pericles, also were accompanied by transformative politics, by the outbreak of war, by the imposition of tyrannical controls. So if you look at history in long enough intervals, you can see plenty of examples. The problem is, because pandemics are not as frequent as war,
yes,
people are not as vigilant about it. And I think this is part of the reason we got gulled into this idea, well, this is an exceptional thing, it really exceptional, so exceptional times call for exceptional measures, where people would not have accepted that degree of regimentation in the event of, say, a war.
Yeah, but after 3 months, it was clear that it was not as deadly as they first told us. And it was clear that the antidote, the remedy, was worse than the disease. And everyone should have gotten on board. The Romanians, of course, they like you said, we were just 40 years removed from this. I think we need to get more to a point. And I think that's happening. I mean, the media trust now is like 30%. People realize that when the government is saying something through the media, it's time to be suspect. And this all comes back to, usually on the fourth segment, we do our take action. We have a few seconds left. But this is just another reason, another more reinforcement of why we need to get out of these international organizations. Thanks, Steve. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And we'll see you tomorrow.